From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Over the next two programs, we're going to take an in-depth look at the issue of euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. Several European countries, as well as Colombia, Canada, and six U.S. states, allow either euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide, and as more jurisdictions consider allowing terminally ill patients to end their lives voluntarily, we thought it would be illustrative to take a look at this issue in the Netherlands, the first country to formally legalize the practice. Now, euthanasia had been generally accepted there for decades. It was put into law by its parliament in 2001. Now, since 2007, the numbers of people dying this way have risen significantly to nearly 7,000 in 2017. That's about 4% of all the deaths in the country that year. Now, this has led to some controversy about who is allowed to have a doctor end his or her life and in what circumstances that's permissible. This is especially true for people with dementia, as well as for those who are physically healthy but are suffering from severe psychological disorders. And one well-known case was that of a physically healthy 38-year-old man named Elko de Hoeyer. Elko had major psychological issues and had been extremely unhappy in life for a long time. He decided to be legally euthanized in 2016. His decision to die and his family's reaction to it is the subject of a new documentary called A Dignified Death. Here to talk more about Elko's life and his choice to end it through euthanization is his father, Bert de Hoeyer. He joins us now from Tilburg in the Netherlands. Bert, welcome.
So you're very welcome here also.
Well, if you could start off telling us about your son, Elko. How would you describe him? How would you describe his personality?
A very nice guy as a kid, but always with difficulties from younger on.
What do you mean by difficulties?
You had to explain everything to him. His he was very delicate. His IQ was very high. So he was always thinking, always. He was not playing at all. Everything had to be useful. He was different.
You say he was different.
He was different.
He had a very high IQ. He didn't play. Yeah. Was he diagnosed with psychological disorders?
Not at that moment. Later on, yes.
Your wife, Monique de Hoeyer, has said that when he was 7 years old, she found him standing near a window as if to jump, asking about what use it was to go on living.
He never asked for a living, he said. And why are you living for? You have to go to work. You have to go to school. Not my choice, he said. There's always a reason. He asked a reason for living. And we couldn't tell him. We're not a religion. That may be something that's different.
Did he talk about suicide for some period of time?
No, not at that age. No. It was later on.
Well, when did he first begin talking about euthanasia?
Euthanasia was later on, very later on. First, he had talked about that he could understand people who take their own life. And suicide, I think it's not a real word for it. Take your own life.
And so when he told you and your wife about his decision to pursue euthanasia, what was your reaction?
The mind was different than for my wife, because she understand him completely. But she had seen the struggle much more than I do. I was working. I always saw a little light at the horizon, and Monique didn't see it anymore. He was struggling with life, always. And he could help other people, but not himself.
I mean, were you afraid, were you or your wife concerned that he would commit suicide, that he would jump in front of a train or jump off a bridge?
Yes. He then said, I will go to the front door and not take other people in, to make other people involved with it. my hobby is trains and public transport. And he said, train drivers don't need to be afraid for me. He want no trauma for other persons. And he said also, I'm worried when I decide to die that no other person get a trauma for me. So euthanasia was, for him, the only way.
So he saw this as the only way. So he wanted to end his life. He didn't want to cause trauma to other people, to train drivers, to somebody else who might find
somebody with a big building or in a river or something like that. No. And he said, I'm worth to go on my own way with respect. And he's gone. It was with respect that he leaves us.
Well, how did the physicians react to Elko's request when he went to the doctors to request euthanasia?
That's not so simple. He had a person he trusts very, very well. One of the many people who tried to help him. And he made his special relation with somebody who becomes very... this year, his title. He was a client. We don't say patient. He was a client from that guy. And he trusts them completely. And that's the one who also said when he have tried everything. I understand his feelings. He thought about euthanasia 3 years, but he was thinking much more. But he was a grown-up guy who was intelligent. So he had ask our permission, but he did. And we understand it.
So he had a physician who supported him in this request, who saw that he didn't have other options. It sounds like you and your wife had some slightly different views about this as well. I wanted to ask you about the decision that he made to have his death filmed, his euthanasia filmed and documented. Why was that important for Elko to have his last days?
He was involved in a project here in Tilburg with several clients, patients, who tell their way to Jesse, who worked in volunteering business, and they made portraits of some people. And one of the members there take her life, and he want to let it see what after it happens to the people that she loved, and that it could be a relief for us. It is not, it is a kind of relief for us, certainly. We have no questions anymore. We have rest one way or another, but he want to let see that when somebody have cancer or something like that, everyone said, "When I can understand, you want to leave this life, you want to not suffering anymore, you have pain, but also his problems were not visible, but they were really, it was very bad for him living."
I wanted to ask you about the issue of euthanasia in the Netherlands, because obviously Elko's case is very well known, and critics of euthanasia say that this is sort of emblematic of a slippery slope where people, maybe there was never an intention when this law was passed that people like Elko should be eligible for euthanasia, and that it shouldn't have been permitted. How do you respond to that?
I can understand that people very well, but it is not so easy as they think it is. It is a very long way. They ask everything. They ask the family. They ask every possibility. Have you tried this? Have you tried this? Have you tried that? He's even moved from one house to another to give it a second try, another environment. He tried everything. And that's the reason why he get it. But a lot of people asked it. And I understand also that a lot of people ask for euthanasia, and I'm very happy that this, yeah, it's so we're used to it, that is possible, but it is not so easy. When there are 100 people that ask it on the reason why Ilko get it, maybe 2 or 3.
No, 1,000.
Or my wife said, on 1,000 people, only 4 or 5 get it. But nobody asked afterwards how many people from that group take their own life after it.
They commit suicide by other means.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a very salient point. And Bert De Hoeyer, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Ah, please, you're welcome.
If you're just tuning in, this is Global Journalist. On today's program, the first in a two-part series on the issue of euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide in different countries. Today's show is focusing on the Netherlands, where the norms around euthanasia have changed since the practice was first legalized in 2001. To broaden our discussion now, we're going to bring in two other people who have followed this issue closely. Joining us from Groningen in the Netherlands is Theo Boer. From 2005 to 2014, he was a member of one of the Netherlands' 5 regional committees that oversee euthanasia. He's now a professor of healthcare ethics at the Protestant Theological University. Theo, welcome.
Thank you.
And with us from Amsterdam is Marianne Snijdevind. She's a medical ethics researcher at Amsterdam UMC, and she also teaches medical ethics at the University of Amsterdam. Marianne, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Theo Boer, if I could start with you. From 2005 to 2014, you were on a regional committee that oversees euthanasia cases in the Netherlands. Talk to us about what those committees do, how sort of the legal framework for euthanasia in the Netherlands works.
Well, in the Netherlands, every case of euthanasia has to be reported, not before, but after the fact. So the doctor, he performs the euthanasia and has to fulfill 5 different criteria. There should be a request of a competent patient. There should be unbearable suffering. There should be a hopeless situation, cannot be become better. A second physician should be involved, giving his opinion, and then it should have been done medically in an advisable manner. So these reports are being sent to the committees, and in the committees there are 3 persons, which is a lawyer, an ethicist, and a physician, and they make sure after the fact whether or not a euthanasia case was, so to say, in order legally.
Well, Marianne Snijdevind, you've been researching euthanasia for years. Give us just a sense from the perspective of the patient, of the person who's seeking euthanasia. What is the process like for them?
Yeah, I first want to address a different subject about that euthanasia in the Netherlands is legalized. It still falls within the criminal law, so it's legally regulated, but not legalized. I think that's an important distinction to make, because it also means that a physician can always reject a request for euthanasia. So you asked about a patient's perspective.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. That's a good point to make, and thank you for clarifying that. But I was hoping you could tell us just a little bit about, from the patient's perspective, what is the process like when you're seeking euthanasia?
Well, you have to ask your physician, and most often it will be your general physician for euthanasia. And then, as Theo also mentioned, you have the physician in place have to be convinced that the due care criteria have been met in order to access euthanasia.
Well, Theo Boer, talk to us. What were your views on this topic when this law first passed in 2001?
I think that I was largely in support of this law, realizing that it had a real large democratic support in, I think, about 80 or 90% of the population. Moreover, I could also imagine that people could ask for euthanasia if they were facing the prospect of a terrible death. However, during the years that I was on the euthanasia control panel, I have seen and also been involved myself in what I see that a sliding practice in which we, so to speak, went from euthanasia as the last resort, preventing a terrible death to happen, to euthanasia as a last resort to prevent a terrible life. You see, and that's where I start.
Well, I'm sorry,
problems.
If you could just explain what you mean by that. You said you went from euthanasia to prevent a terrible death to you think the country has moved to euthanasia to prevent a terrible life.
Thank you. That's a good question, because most of the countries in the world, for example, including the US and Canada, they have in their laws written that a person who is eligible for euthanasia or a physician assisted dying should be, so to speak, a natural death is will soon follow within a couple of weeks or within half a year. So where I can see that can be a good thing to prevent a terrible death to happen in terms of pain and nausea and people afraid of choking, etc. What we see now since about 2009 is that the life expectation of a considerable number of patients has increased. I have seen in my reports, I've seen in total 4,000 reports, and I've seen about 400 people who had a life expectation of more than 2 years. On average, their life expectation was 7.3 years, which means that I think that here we are perhaps trying to solve a social or an existential problem by medical means.
And that would seem to be the case with Elko de Hoyer, it sounds like, because he was physically healthy in many ways, even though, as his parents made quite clear, he was very unhappy in life, likely would have committed suicide.
Yeah. Yes, but he had a medical diagnosis, absolutely. So he didn't have a foreseeable death, but he suffered very much from his illness.
Marianne, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, what Theo mentioned, I was wondering if he would call that a slippery slope or not. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, if you could expand on that, Theo, is it the case that sort of as supply has become available of euthanasia, has it increased the number of people who are demanding it?
If you're a professional ethicist, you'd better not use the term slippery slope, because it is a very hard term. But what is meant by it is that if you allow one thing to happen, some other consequences may follow that you haven't anticipated or you haven't intended.
Yeah.
I actually think that is what has happened, yes.
Yeah, okay. And I'm sorry, Marianne, if you want to jump in, what do you see as some of these perhaps unanticipated consequences?
No, I don't think that it was unintended, because the law was formulated that there had to be medical grounds for euthanasia to be acceptable, and that is still the case. So I think it's really hard to say that this was not the intent of the law.
I mean, do you think, sorry, Marianne, we heard Elko de Hoyer's story earlier. Do you think in 2001 mm-hmm. that the law was passed with the intent that people like him, 38
yes.
years old, physically healthy, would be able to choose euthanasia?
Yes, for instance. It was meant also for psychiatric patients to be included. That the fact that the due care criteria state there has to be unbearable suffering and not state a patient should be terminal ill just is exemplary for that.
So in a way, then, it sounds like this term unbearable suffering is the key sort of legal definition for determining this. But Theo, talk to us just a little bit mm-hmm. about issues that arise with regard to people with dementia or who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Well, you see, I do agree that the law doesn't state that you have to be close to your natural death. So I do accept that point. But the fact is that the committees where euthanasia is controlled, that the committees in the beginning years were very keen on preventing those cases to happen. And I was wondering if you know the numbers, but when I started in the committee, we had per year about one or two psychiatric patients, and at most we had one dementia patient. So if I can show you just the numbers of the, I don't know if you can see them, but you can see how they mm-hmm. went up since about 1900.
Since 2007, it sounds like the numbers have increased from, I think it's something yes. like around 2,000 euthanasia cases per year to 7,000 in 2017, almost 7,000.
Well, yes. Yes, and what I was indicating was that the chart that I showed you was the numbers of dementia patients and psychiatric patients. So yes, in principle, it was possible right from the beginning, but we were very hesitant to allow it. And what we see now is, I think what you see is that the supply, the possibility of euthanasia for people with a long life expectation may induce some demand. And that is what worries me.
And so in other words, then, it sounds like people who may be diagnosed with dementia but are still have most or nearly all of their mental faculties are choosing to be euthanized, even when their physical life could still go on for years and years.
Yes, and that has to do with a certain view of what life should be. And what I think, generally speaking, I can very much sympathize with Ilko and with his parents, Ilko, who had euthanasia, and I have no point in criticizing them at all. But what I do see is that life for all of us can be very, very hard, very hard. And what we need is more resolve to deal with life's difficulties. What I'm afraid of is that the possibility of euthanasia may lead us to not be as determined to cope with very hard and very severe and lasting suffering.
Marianne Snyder, what do you make of that? I mean, it sounds like Theo is saying that actually by beginning this process, it's sort of changed in a way the culture, sort of the moral thought of the country around this issue.
I think it's hard to say something about this from a research perspective, but what I do found was that for physicians, euthanasia and considering a request or performing euthanasia is still very hard. So from a physician perspective, I think it is still not...
Theo, if I could turn this discussion now to palliative treatment, palliative death, talk to us just a little bit about what the distinctions are between that and euthanasia and how doctors and the wider community views that.
Well, if you're talking about the end of life, then there is euthanasia, which is, of course, using an injection to kill the patient right away. And then you have all different kind of palliative options. We call palliation, that is to reduce the suffering by means of using a morphine, etc., where the patient isn't killed, but can live on in a more comfortable state. However, the problem with people like Ilko, who has a psychiatric condition, is that there's hardly any palliative care for people like him. When I have cancer, there's hospices, there's palliative sedation, meaning that people will bring me to sleep and I will die from the illness in my sleep. However, for a person like Ilko, there may be years and years of severe suffering where there's no palliative care. And I think that is something that really needs to be addressed. Their lives can be very miserable indeed.
Well, Theo, if I could just ask you a little bit more on this point about palliative death. If what is happening is that people are being given heavy doses of morphine or sedatives or anesthesia to ease their suffering with the full knowledge that the person is likely to stop breathing, or if their intravenous fluids are being removed with the knowledge that they'll likely die of dehydration, how is that ethically distinct from giving them euthanasia?
Well, of officially, the Dutch Physicians Organization has said that you may only sedate patients, which is bringing them in a coma. You can only sedate them if their life expectation is lesser than about 8 days, which means that they will be dying anyway, and you just save them from experiencing this death process in a conscious state. So if you're referring to a patient dying from the sedation or dying from from the morphine. I think that's what we call slow euthanasia, and I think that's wrong. I think in that case we should resort to what is called normal euthanasia with the proper processes that surround it.
Because in that case, the patient himself or herself is actually making the request,
exactly,
rather than mm-hmm. having the doctor or the family members determine that. Marianne Snijdevjan, we're running short on time here. I wanted to ask you where you think this issue is going in the Netherlands over the next several years. We've touched on some issues of controversy and contention there. What do you think this will look like 5 years from now?
I think the discussion will just continue about patients suffering from a psychiatric disease, patients who consider their life completed, patients suffering from dementia. These are always difficult cases. So I think discussion will remain.
Yeah, Theo, if I could pose that to you as well, because I understand mm-hmm. that there have been proposals, even a movement in the Netherlands for this sort of full life, I guess, treatment, if you will, which would allow people to be prescribed medicine that would end their life. And basically anyone over a certain age, over age 70 or age 75, would have that option sort of no matter their health status.
Yes, that is a movement that is being pursued by some. There's also many people who have great criticism about that, but the law proposal that some propose is that anyone over 70 or 75 can have a lethal dosage of sedatives or killing means, and that of course poses the question, why should a society help anyone over 70 to be killed and not over 65? And I really hope that this will not be the consequence. And I actually do expect that some intelligent people may decide not to have that.
Well, what advice, Theo, would you give to other countries, other jurisdictions who are considering similar laws now? You yourself have been a euthanasia supporter. What would you tell other policymakers?
Well, what I would call, what I would say, and even though I think that I would be very sorry for people like Elko, really, but I would actually strongly recommend other legislations to limit euthanasia to people who have the diagnosis that they will soon die. And all other all expansion of this will probably lead to situations that we didn't anticipate or that are detrimental to our resolve to cope with suffering.
We're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Bert de Hoyer, Theo Boer, and Marianne Snijdevjan for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Molly Jackson, Kyle Lahushik, and Francesca Stottlemyre. Our supervising producer is Rosie Belson. Grace Lett is visual editor. Aaron Hay and Takiya Thomas are the audio engineers. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.